One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine.
Let's go, Ernie! Let's go,
Welcome back to the Vacation Bible School Podcast. We have reached a very exciting portion of the story. We are actually going to learn how to, you know, live our lives. We've just been kind of winging it through much of Genesis and parts of Exodus. But hey, it's actually time to get some instructions from the big guy. I am Jason Kirk. I am joined, as always, by Emily Kirk. How are you today?
Oh, good. How are you?
Fine. And we are also joined by an assortment of associate pastors from our Patreon, as well as some other special guests. How's everyone doing? Can we get a big amen from the whole congregation?
Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Let's know Alabama's the first on the board. Thank you, Justin. So the story we're going to get to today is the Ten Commandments. When we left our heroes, we have encountered Mount Sinai, and we sort of broke up the stories and the laws a little bit, because in the Bible, they're very mixed together, and it'd be kind of impossible to just bounce between the two of them forever, so we're sort of splitting them up into their own contained episodes. We have just had the experience of the nation of Israelites have looked up and beheld this screaming, thundering volcano god, and oh, it's very terrifying. What happens in the middle of that is Moses goes up to meet God and finally receives the first of 613 or more laws in the course of the Torah. The first 10 are the very important ones. This is very helpful to Moses because last we saw him in action, he was having to serve as the judge of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions, however you like, people. And he learned from his father-in-law he needs to delegate. Now he's going to learn from all of our father-in-law. our law father.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, father of the law.
Right.
It's time to get some rules. So Moses is still serving as the go-between. In Exodus 19, the Israelites all told Moses to tell God they agreed to the basic terms of the deal. Keep his covenants, and he'll make them his treasured possession, his kingdom of priests. Now God is giving Moses the stuff you agree to on page 2 of the terms of service, the initial commandments. Usually you just click through these things, but these are pretty substantial. You should probably read them carefully. So God issues these first 10 laws to Moses, but all the Israelites gathered around the foot of Sinai can hear. Remember, they can't touch it or they will explode or whatever. If they don't, you have to murder them yourselves. This is a very family-friendly book. This becomes what we talked about in the last episode. You know, they're hearing the thundering voice of God and they're like, no, this is horrible. Please, can Moses do not just the talking, but also the listening? And then that becomes the system from there on out. To this point, God's rules had basically been, don't try to steal his control over who lives and who dies. That was kind of the law of Genesis. Don't murder. God's been hung up on human procreation for all of Genesis and parts of Exodus as well. There's a lot of stuff about private parts. You know, also make sure you do the Passover stuff and Sabbath stuff. And there have we'll get yet another explanation for why Sabbath is a thing. But wait, there's another one on the way in Deuteronomy. And also don't make Nephilim, which I think that is the easiest law to keep. I think we're good.
We're not given many opportunities to create Nephilim. So.
It's very difficult. Otherwise, back in Genesis, God was mostly fine with the Hebrews obeying local customs. Abraham negotiates with the Hittites, you know, sort of on their terms. Jacob negotiates with the Shechems. I don't know what you call the people, the Shechemites. Joseph becomes an Egyptian politician and functions as one. But now it's time for some custom rules for these people. We arrive at Exodus 20, one of the, like, I don't know, three or so most famous passages in the Bible. Maybe up there with Genesis 1 and, like, amalgamated Jesus stuff, I guess. First, so the Psalms in general.
Yeah.
Just
all
the,
of it.
The general pleasant coup of Psalms. Right. So, two notes before we get going. One is there are at least 8 different versions of the commandments and which sentence belongs in which. There's a Jewish Talmud version, a Lutheran version, a Catholic version. Some of them, you know, and they're all basically the same. It's all the same stuff. It's all the same verses, but it's about where you draw the lines. The Jewish version makes God's intro, I am the Lord your God. That is functionally the first commandment. And some versions split the 10th commandment into 2 or 3 very, very similar things. It's all the same stuff. We're going to use the Protestant order because house rules, but it's all the same stuff. We'll cover all the material either way. The other thing is we're going to do a little game since we got a group tonight. As we go through each one, we'll all take some sort of a vote on whether we agree to abide by this rule or not. This is what the Israelites had to do in real time. We have the benefit of not staring into the lightning inferno, so we have that going for us.
Oh, hi. Also, one other thing I forgot actually during this recording to note a couple people who are joining. We have Michael Elcon, Braves and Birds on Twitter, who's joining us. You'll hear him very soon talking about Poseidon. And we're also joined by our friend Hassan Masood. You'll hear him around the 10 or 11 minute mark. H-A-S-M-A-S on Twitter. This is our first time trying a live Zoom call episode, so things are a little bit. I probably should have had people, you know, introduce themselves so we can sort of put names with voices. But hey, we'll clean that up for next time. Hey, let's get right to it. Let's get right to the first law.
Okay. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me.
So right off the top, how does this sound? Is this a yes or a no?
Seems pretty easy for me, personally.
It seems kind of limiting. I like options.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
It is good to have options.
Sticking with a plague guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Strong disagree.
Okay, all right. So we got a good range of opinions here. This is good.
I personally agree, but my younger son at one point decided he wanted to worship Poseidon when we read Greek myths, so he vetoes. So we have a divided house on that.
I mean, you can make a strong case that Poseidon's watery elements are very, very Genesis 1 god, very Red Sea god, right? So maybe we can sort of bridge across faiths with your Hellenic son.
I took 3 years of Latin, so I can respect that.
Yeah, Poseidon's dope. It's fine. So in this first commandment, which we had a range of reactions to, as I imagine the Israelites did, God, in this course of the story in Genesis, he escaped Babylon's gods to Abraham. He conquered Egypt's gods, and now he's coming for Canaan's gods. There are other gods. It just straight up says there are other gods, but they're not this god. To oversimplify a little bit, we're still transitioning from, you know, vaguely henotheist Genesis, which, you know, it's worship of one god. We don't really worry about the others, to monolatrous early Israel, the specific worship of one god out of many. And we're still moving toward the like hard monotheism that we think of as biblical Abrahamic religion. This is set still right around 1300 BC. Around this very general time zone, to heavily oversimplify, you know, archaeology suggests that Canaanites, Proto-Israelites, some are between worshiping the Canaanite pantheon, worshiping the god of Genesis, who could be a version of Canaanite Odin mixed with Canaanite Thor. This is kind of a fun way to put it. If you buy the Levite theory that the Exodus isn't necessarily about all the Israelites, but more Moses' tribe of warrior priests, then worship of YHWH, Yahweh, is coming up from Egypt, Midian, merging with the Canaanite All-Father, becoming the God we know God. That would sort of be a very, very simple version of like the outside the story stance taken by a lot of scholars. Within the story, it's all very straightforward. It's all the same God. When this was set, remember, we're telling a bunch of former Egyptian polytheists, not by choice, that where they're going, they're not to worship Moloch or Asherah or Baal. But it's flexible beyond just literally other gods. Later, Jesus uses this verse to tell rich monotheists to stop worshiping money, a verse recently misunderstood by noted theologian Marco Rubio. And Jesus expanded, and he wasn't the first to expand it in that way, but his popularized usage of that verse led to thousands of youth pastors telling teens to stop worshiping video games. You know. Did you ever have a youth pastor do that? It says, don't worship mammon. That means don't worship boyfriends and sports teams. And
well, yeah, general things, sure.
And they always make it sound like impossibly. Like I know you're going to spend all Saturday rooting on your sports team to get a big touchdown.
That wasn't a big thing in the Midwest.
Okay.
We were near KU, so.
So you're good on that one. So you can keep the Sabbath.
But we have the Chiefs, so.
Okay, but Sunday's a problem. I got it. So in this story is most likely written somewhere around 900, 700 BC, whatever, and you can find a million scholars who will argue every month within that zone. The Israelite kingdom is constantly fending off rival polytheist nations. When the story is edited and finalized around 500, 400 BC, the Jews are leaving captivity in polytheist Babylon. All that time, their biggest unifier is having one specific God. So commandment number one is, in addition to being about God, it's to remember who you are, your lineage, your history. It's about keeping one story alive. And 3,000 years later, it worked. That's pretty amazing. The more we read, the more astounded I am that it worked. That's awesome.
It took a long time to get to that point.
Here's a wrinkle, all right? a 2020 specific loophole. So when this was set, atheism wasn't really a very familiar thing. Even, you know, when this was edited, it really wasn't a widespread thing in this part of the world. 2,500, 3,000 years ago, God stories explain why the world exists. Being an atheist 3,000 years ago, it'd be kind of like denying both all religion and all science at once. That means our atheist friends have a life hack here, a way to avoid breaking the first commandment. You don't put any gods anywhere. Then you're not putting any gods above Yahweh. You're good, right?
It's very simple. How do we feel about all that?
I did want to add, coming from a Muslim background, raised Muslim, I'm basically now, you know, spiritual, just all over the place. But growing up, essentially that first commandment for us was probably the most important commandment of them all, that there is no God but God. In fact, when you actually announce your commitment to Islam, or basically when you convert to Islam, you give what essentially is called bearing witness, or the Shahada. And literally the first part of that when you convert is that there is no God but God. So basically for us, that was every, if you had to like rank the commandments, essentially, that's probably the most important one for us.
I would say that's probably true for Christianity.
I think the order is very important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like it does feel very intentional.
You can make an argument that like the following commandments, breaking them also breaks the first commandment.
Right.
You can. You find a lot of rabbinical interpretations that like really connect these things, you know, just millions and millions of arguments over 3,000 years that, you know, these things just interconnect in so many ways.
Yeah, I think along with that, if those of you who follow, you know, the Nicene Creed and starting with, I believe in one God, I feel like that's kind of an affirmation of the first commandment as well.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, religions are all kind of competitive, so they have to start with that, or there's kind of everything's phased away, I guess.
So we look back at the Bible, right? And we see like, this is the one that won. Like this won the region. It launched the world's two biggest religions. It defined monotheism for throughout history to this point, whether it was first or not, it was close to first. This story won. I mean, I think you made the case that like firm commitment right off the top to like the single rarest thing about the story played a big part, because it's an easy story, right? It's an easy idea to sell. Let's go to commandment number two. This one is sort of spins off the first one.
Yeah. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of parents to the third and fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments.
So first thing there, we talked a little bit with Dr. Friedman in the last episode, the idea that New Testament God is super, super nice guy God and quote unquote Old Testament God is big, mean, scary God. We notice what happened there, right? If you're bad, it'll be bad for about three generations. If you're good, 1,000 generations of what exactly does it say there?
Steadfast love.
I think the consistent message of the Hebrew Bible is that like God wants to love us, and he wants to do that much more than he wants to punish us. And it says so right there, like right at the beginning of the second commandment. So based on just what's in the Bible, how do we feel about that one?
I'm good with it, just because I'm not artistic. I have a hard time making an idol.
I feel like it would be hard to agree with the first one and go against this one, so I'm just going to give it a thumbs up.
Did the Israelites have household idols?
It was a thing in the region for sure. They weren't really supposed to. There are stories later in the Bible of like, there's some stuff that made the cut that I don't really know if it was supposed to. There's a few laws that are actually just a few chapters after this about, you know, a household servant. If they agree on a certain thing, they have to turn and face the gods in the house. And it's like this ceremony that like, did y'all mean to put this in here? Because you just said, you know, yeah, they weren't supposed to. And it's from what I've read archaeologically, they actually followed like the stuff that we read about. If you look up what is the, you know, the most ancient record of ancient Israel, it's like, well, there's these people who they didn't eat pigs because there's no pig bones. And they didn't have, it is very difficult to find something that we can document and say, this is an image of Yahweh/El God. We can find gods throughout the region, but no one that I know of has said, this is a graven image of the God we know of. You know, you might know him as Jehovah, Yahweh, whatever. So yeah, it was a thing that, as far as we know, they stuck to. And it becomes a dispute, you know, later in the Bible, where there are various kings who, there's a, in 1st and 2nd Kings, the author is given kings a thumbs up, thumbs down. All the thumbs down kings are the ones who say, yeah, let's do idols. So it's a constant battle throughout the Bible. Any other objections to following this commandment? I feel like I can follow this one fine.
I was just kind of curious. I mean, with right now, with all of the illustrations of Muhammad and all of that, was there a time that there was, you could not have an image of God in the monotheistic religions, and then is that over with Christianity? We're happy with slapping up Jesus on any wall we want to, but Islam still holds firm to not putting the image out there and that being an idol of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, in Christianity, anything goes, like, you know.
Yeah, I don't ever remember hearing that you couldn't. So, I mean, I think we all had that one very recognizable picture of Jesus, like profile view, kind of a sepia-toned.
So one thing that people often bring up is like, well, what about Catholics? Because those folks like art, right? It's specifically about art that you are worshiping, you know, not necessarily art that you are appreciating or revering. And if you look at the language, it says, don't make images that represent things in the sky and on the ground, in the water. And you can, you know, we can all think of, all right, Zeus, Poseidon, Hades, right? Like, you can connect those to like the basic building blocks of any pantheon. So like, that's what it's about is, you know, don't represent these small pieces of God. God is too big to be represented or contained in one idol, one image, one icon. We, you know, God looks like whatever God wants to look like. God has represented himself, herself, themselves as a man walking around the earth, as a thundering volcano, as, I would say, as a snake in early in Genesis, but not a popular interpretation, as a sea monster. God's a lot of stuff, and to try to reduce God to like a genie that's not the idea.
Jason, I was going to say that I'm totally cool with commandment number two, and I had a lot of questions as to whether Catholics specifically or Christians generally had it in their Bibles when I spent a week in Italy. Like, you go into enough churches and you're like, holy cow, they seem to have a different interpretation than Jews do. And I was on that trip with another Jewish person, and we were like, did they miss commandment two? Or did our rabbis tell us something about commandment two that's not really in there? And then you find out that Muslims agree with us, and so now we get to gang up on the Christians.
Yeah, there's always these shifting allegiances as you go verse by verse.
It's just funny the way the East versus the West, at least when you look at the split in Christianity and how that contributes to quote unquote worship versus venerating versus everything like that, because at least from my perspective, and at least from like what I understand, the traditions of iconography stems back even to the early first century of Christianity. In certain traditions, you would even hear that Christ basically painted the first icon by basically wiping his face with a cloth.
Yeah, the words that feel very similar to worship but are not worship, right? Like, that's a thing that requires a lot of like careful, precise thought, you know? A lot of thought has gone into parsing exactly what it means to revere and respect but not worship, you know?
I'm 0-2 on these commandments because it's a novelty Jimmy Carter mug that I found downstairs. It is my God now, so I'm 0-2 on the commandments.
Okay, that's fine, though. That's fine.
And that mug is not going to do well when we get to the commandment on I shall not covet.
Yeah, we're all breaking
down.
I know.
I'm
right now.
I'm staring down the barrel at that one.
Drew, I think you're going to rally in the later commandments. We got a comeback coming. Yeah, this is one that really gets connected to the other ones. Like in the Talmud, ancient rabbis tie idolatry and the whole law together, sort of from the idea of like, how can you follow the law if you follow an object? That's not the thing that gave you the law. The Sanhedrin, the Jewish elder court around the time of the Roman Empire, they believed idolatry to be roughly as bad as murder. Like it was like, you know, everyone agrees murder is usually going to be the worst thing to break, but they had idolatry like right up there. And it's fascinating to think about how radical this anti-idolatry idea was. Like that was just universal, you know, every culture on earth represented gods, you know, in art, physically, in some way. I shouldn't say every, but and we have the priests of this one specific nation want their nation to commit so hard to something contrary, and again, it worked. The funny part about this, after the commandments, so Exodus 20, most of it is the commandments. There's this little part trailing off at the end where God says, all right, you're talking to Moses. After the Israelites say, please stop screaming at us, God says, Moses, come here. Let's talk about a couple things. One of them is, all right, when you go out to set up altars to worship, I want you to do it like my guy Abraham did it back in Genesis, which was setting up some rocks, making a very simple little altar. Don't cut the rocks. Don't mold things. Take the rocks as you find them. It's a very naturalist idea of building a space of worship. And then the story of the golden calf happens, which we'll get to hopefully in our next episode. And God changes his mind and says, fine, we are going all in on ornate, elaborate gold. You can represent, I want. We joked in our first episode about the cherubim as, you know, our idea of like the fat angel babies. Those are actually like sphinxes. Those are like winged, lion-headed, people-faced horses. Like, sure, yeah, you want golden cherubim, fine. And God sort of just flattens them with like 15 straight chapters of how to do very, very religious stuff. You didn't want simple rock sculptures? Fine.
I think just technology vastly improved in the time that he made the commandment versus...
So, two commandments in. There is a break right here. Per tradition and extremely close reading, these two commandments were the only two literally directly from God's mouth, however God talks. In the first, God said, I am the Lord. In the second, God said, I am a jealous God. There are no more I's in the rest of the commandments. God speaks in the third person in one or two of them. It's almost like God is passing the mic to Moses. And some Bibles don't even use quote marks for the Ten Commandments because if you get really, really granular in it, it's hard to say exactly when God stops talking. There's story there that's right behind the text just because of like the pronoun goes away and gets replaced with the second person. And it could just be like, God suddenly starts talking like the rock, and that's fine. But for a long time, a lot of rabbis have taught that the first two commandments are set apart from the following 611 or however many. So yeah. Hey, let's go to number three.
Okay. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not acquit anyone who misuses his name.
How are you feeling about this one? I'm feeling bad myself.
I feel great about this one. I have the cleanest mouth of anyone
I know. Good.
I'm pretty awful about that one, I have to admit.
Every Saturday Georgia plays, I'm out.
I think I know like 10 people that can say that they abide by this one.
Abide by the usual interpretation.
Yeah, and most of them are in my family. So
okay.
Basically anyone outside of my family, no.
So this is a fun one because we take it to mean don't say God damn it, basically. But it can mean a lot of things, and we don't really know exactly what all it means. It could be about oaths. I swear to God. It could be against trying to use the name of God in magic. Like the Bible essentially teaches that a technology that is magic is real and you should avoid it. It happened in Egypt. It'll happen, you know, for the next few hundred years of the story. Magic is real. Avoid it. Don't play with Dungeons and Dragons and do yoga. In the 90s, we learned that yoga is satanic. So
I didn't learn that.
Shout out to Frank Peretti. And then, you know, don't overuse it casually and trivialize it, and definitely don't use it in curses, which, okay, if you say God damn it, all right, that's a curse.
Ooh, coins for the swear jar.
Since we don't know exactly what the author had in mind, many Jews avoid, you know, spelling or saying or attempting to pronounce names of God just to be on the safe side. So if you see, you know, G/D written out, that's what's happening there. The most common idea is don't swear to God, as in don't promise and then fail to follow through. Jesus extends this to don't swear by anything. Live in such a way that when you say yes, people know that it means yes, period. You can also extend this to don't claim to follow God. Don't bear the name of God if you're not going to try all that hard to live up to it, Republican Party. And there's an argument that it doesn't refer to cussing at all, because like lots of biblical prayers and psalms and the prophets are violent, angry curses, right? Saying, comes the third one, God damn it, is a prayer if you think about it, right? Because we're saying, God, please bring down punishment on this specific thing. He would probably say no, but not all prayers get answered. All right.
You need the right punctuation for that.
Yeah, yeah, you have to be careful. You have to be sure. You have to be sure the comma's in there.
So this is like literally something that I have never in my life said, and I don't think I ever could, and probably that has a lot to do with my upbringing, but I don't say any curse words. I tried it for like a week. It just didn't work for me. So for me, this has always been something that it was just, you don't say God's name with emptiness behind it. And so for me, that just means anything that's not about him or relating to him in the way that like the Bible would say.
Yeah, I think don't say it in an empty way. I think that definitely has something to do with what the original author meant.
Yeah.
Any more thoughts on this one?
0 for 3.
Drew, the comeback is still on its way. Here we go. So from this one onward, most of the rest of the laws can apply to anybody, atheist, whatever. Even if you don't convert to Judaism, you can still be a righteous Gentile like Noah was. And, according to the rabbis, you can still have a place in God's eventual new kingdom. There is an entirely different list of commandments called the Noahide laws, written down by rabbis hundreds of years later and based on stories from Genesis rather than laws of Exodus. They're basically the Ten Commandments, very pretty close to it with a few changes. It's Noah was not Jewish, but Noah was called righteous before there was a law. There's even a religion called Noahidism for people who specifically want to be righteous Gentiles. They don't want to be Christians. They want to be righteous Gentiles. It's like, it's almost like Old Testament Christianity. It's pretty fascinating, pretty interesting. Next one, number 4. This is a fun one. This you do the 3 hard things and then you get your reward.
Okay. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the 7th day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the alien resident in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, but rested the 7th day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it.
A day off. How's that sound, y'all?
Sounds great, but I haven't done that in a long time.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, I'm in.
Mike, how are we feeling about the Sabbath these days?
Judaism has this strange ability to make things that should be fun into unfun, and one of them is that the Jewish interpretation of not working has extended to not using a car or not using electricity, because lighting a fire or utilizing fire was considered to be work. So if I were an Orthodox Jew, I would not be able to watch college football on Saturdays, which honestly, I'm considering Orthodox Judaism at this point for that reason. Thank you, Jim Harbaugh. and I've had this whole debate with my father, who's an Orthodox Jew, that while fire may have been interpreted as work 3,000 years ago, it is not, turning on a TV is not work in any sense now. But Orthodox Jews view that very differently. The conclusion is Judaism has turned what should have been an easy commandment and a fun commandment into something that can be a challenge.
We've had a lot of time to argue about it, right? So like things get complicated over time.
Yeah, and we're good at that.
I was reading one old argument that was basically like, well, if you live so far away from synagogue that you need a car to get there, you should simply move closer. What a simple hack that is. So taking off work every 7th day, this was already kind of a thing in parts of Mesopotamia. It often gets described as more out of like superstition or custom, or just like literally, hey, people need days off. As always, when the Bible shows its older Middle Eastern influences, the differences are what matter most. In the Bible, it's a complete break from all other days, not just a holiday. And it's about a positive memory, God resting to admire the planet he gave to people. Later on, it also acquires a memory of the liberation from Egypt. Let's note, again, like we talked about last episode, the Sabbath extends to immigrants and servants and animals. One of several verses in the law that advocate for treating animals like you'd treat people. Even the bloody, disgusting sacrifices laws in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, which we'll get to, convey some dignity in animal life. As we see in Leviticus, this is kind of where it gets fun. There's a very anti-capitalist root here to the idea of the Sabbath. Don't maximize profits. Don't squeeze everything you can out of people or out of the environment. We see in Leviticus goes hard on give the land a break. You cannot frack in Leviticus. Slow down, stop, breathe, quit your side hustle. You're never going to get ahead anyway. Later in the Bible, this applies to all commerce, not just labor. Just unplug from a buying and selling society, which... like, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible where like, how old-fashioned. And then every now and then you come across something, even in the bloody, nasty book of Leviticus, that you're like, okay, this is There's progressive ideas even here, you know, by today's standards. A community of people keeping the Sabbath in a way that God instructs, that means a whole company of people who have to rely on each other. You know, telling people they have to take days off, that feels like privileged, right? Like, because like poor people need to work. But the rest of the law that we'll get to show rich people must take care of poor people. So for those two things to work together, the Torah is one big social safety net. And it's not optional charity and it's not philanthropy that you get praised for. It is the law to take care of poor people. They get to take a day off just like a rich person does. Any other thoughts on the Sabbath?
Is a live sacrifice considered work?
Live sacrifice?
I feel like we'll cover that soon.
Yeah, we got about 10 chapters on that to come pretty soon. So a live sacrifice. Yeah. You have to get rid of all the blood. One of the very first laws in Genesis is don't eat anything that's still living. So
Sabbath's better when you live in a state without blue laws.
So those were the four very, very spiritual laws. We will now turn to the earthly realm. Number 5.
Honor your father and your mother so that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you.
More agreeable already, right? We can all do this. Yeah, even Drew's on board. We love it.
I'm on board.
The comeback starts here.
for some of us, the last couple weeks have been tough for some of us to keep that up.
Amen, brother.
Yeah, political elections tend to test the fifth commandment, I think. So this commandment, it's a sign of a culture that likes old people, unlike ours. Like, again, hey, like, we think we're so advanced and we're so modern. Well, you know, we're a society that just discards old people once they are no longer of economic use, right? And here is a commandment, the first interpersonal commandment straight from God that's saying, no, actually, old people are still good, whether you can squeeze money out of them or not. Also note, it does not just say father. Not only does saying father and mother convey equality right up front in literally the first commandment about people, I think we could also use this if we're trying to lawyer our way out of some of the trickier later laws. We can say, wait a minute, the fifth commandment said father and mother, right? The fifth commandment implies men and women are equal. So if you come across a really sexist, you know, verse in Exodus or Leviticus, you're trumped by the fifth commandment. Any of our lawyers agree that might be at least something to throw out, something to attempt in court?
As a counterpoint to your point that we don't like old people in this country, we just elected a 78-year-old to the highest office in the land. So, you know.
We only like them as politicians. That's it. That's the only job you can do.
That old man's going to work. So, I don't know.
Also, about like Dr. Friedman mentioned last episode, like every kid who reads the Ten Commandments, their first question is like, so what if my parents tell me to steal, right? Because then I'm caught between two different commandments. So there's like a chain of command thing. If your parents tell you to steal, then they are not in turn honoring their parents, all the way back to God, right? It's betraying the entire line of succession. So at least that is what I've seen as the most common interpretation is like, if anyone, including your parents, tells you to break a commandment, well, that sort of breaks that whole chain.
The one thing that I wanted to add here, this is the first commandment. At least my dad, whenever he would preach the Ten Commandments, he would always point out that, hey, this is the first commandment that has a good promise attached to it if you actually do it. Like the first few are like, hey, just do these things. But also, I think that was kind of some reverse psychology also because he was a parent. He had to. hey, God's going to love you if you do this. So come on.
Also, let's remember our author here. According to tradition, these are being written down by Moses, who is not only a dad, but also a dad whose wife has just left him, right? So,
divorce daddy energy.
So,
father's rights, commandments.
Wife guy Moses. Like, here's the thing. You know, we talk about biblical marriage, right? Find a law about biblical marriage. Good luck. There's laws about divorce. Why? Because they're written by wife guy Moses, whose wife just left him. That's why there's divorce laws, not marriage laws. You know, it actually probably wasn't written by Moses, but the storyline's more fun that way. She literally left two chapters ago.
So you're saying that the translation should be here, honor your father and mother. My wife left me.
Honor your father and your mother, despite the fact. Actually, she took the kids, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there you go. Honor your dad, who's up here on a mountain talking about clouds.
Oh, that's why he put father first. It wasn't a sexist thing. It was like, hey, remember me.
I do have a fun little story kind of related to that. Like when I was growing up, a common saying from my parents whenever they tried to like get us to do something for them, like whether that's getting like a cup of water or something, they'd say like, oh, you know, if you do something for your parents, God will build you a house in heaven. And then thinking back, I'm like, wow, I've got a subdivision at this point waiting for me.
You're playing Sim City over there.
I might have been the only kid in my church or in the group of kids around me that were like Christian kids that their parent never threw this at them as a way to get something out of them. I don't remember my mom or dad. Well, my dad wasn't really around, but I don't remember my mom ever saying this.
Has your dad ever heard of this verse?
I'm sure he has.
Okay. Has your dad read this?
That I don't know.
Okay.
Can't guarantee that.
Let's see. We are on to commandment.
We're on 6.
I got a good feeling about this one, too.
I hope we're all on the same page here.
If you disagree to this one, I think we have to report it.
You shall not murder.
Huh? Pretty good one, right? Pretty good one.
Hey,
even Drew's on board. We're good.
So my question here is, what about Among Us?
So I haven't actually played that game, but you tell me if it fits within the commonly accepted stipulations. All right. The first one, people usually agree that justifiable war is acceptable. And the word justifiable is doing massively heavy lifting there. If you're being robbed at night, then it's okay to go ahead and off them. But if it's during the daylight, you have to try to escape from the situation peacefully. Capital punishment. Cause like, hey, Leviticus is constantly telling you to stone people to death. So Those are usually the three big stipulations that are accepted. Would Among Us fit into any of those at all?
So does it really mean Israelites don't murder Israelites?
So yeah, according to the text, don't murder. Just don't murder anyone. Obviously, within the story of the Exodus, and then good grief, the book right after the Exodus, there's lots of murder, and it appears to be sanctioned by God. This is where the idea of justifiable war comes in. So that's a difficult thing. Did God tell people to break this commandment? Or was the ultimate plan fulfilling the promise? Did that simply, supersede everything?
Did I hear correctly that nighttime knife crime is sanctioned by the Bible?
If they break into your house. So it's
so castle doctrine.
The original
night,
castle doctrine. Yes.
With a blade. Okay. All right. Cool.
Nighttime, stand your ground.
I'm just making notes.
Yeah. I was worried that was biblical standard ground, so now more castle.
Yeah, you could possibly hack this in a way, like trap an enemy in your house at night and say, oh, he's robbing me, right? Like, you could probably find a hack there.
But hack, Jason, really? Hack?
A good person would not find
hack,
it.
Hack, yeah. But the 10th commandment, no, we'll get to that one. The 10th commandment sees what you're plotting all along.
Can I also ask for an interpretation on our thoughts on the holy hand grenade of Antioch as well?
That one has all of its own rules. This is from Monty Python. It's,
okay.
Yeah, you're not a big enough
watched
nerd.
Monty Python, but I have not. Yeah.
That one has enough rules attached to it that, like, I think even Moses is like, oh my, you figure it out from here, right? There's also, I'm trying to think exactly what it is in the Quran. People are debating, like, is it okay if someone attacks you at church to defend yourself? You know, if someone tries to murder you at church, would it defile the church to murder them? And the answer is, yeah, they're trying to murder you. Murder them first, right? Like, so there's this idea that if someone is trying to hurt you and you have to defend your own life, then that's their fault. And, you know, that feels consistent in both books.
I don't want to make this political, but that literally, that situation right there was just on the ballot in Alabama for a state amendment. Like they had to like sort that out for like stand your ground laws in churches and stuff like that. So
I feel like though, like going along with that, look, if somebody's trying to murder you at any point in time, and whether in church at night or whatnot, would that not, then that totally falls under the justifiable, and it could just be a one-on-one war.
Right. Yeah. That would be a pretty popular interpretation, you know, and then there's like all sorts of court proceedings, like rabbinical law all the way through is like very, very, human life is deeply precious. The idea is God made one person as a way to say, you know, every person is as valuable as Adam. It's like every person is as valuable as the first person. So taking any life is something to be extremely hesitant about. If it comes down to it and it's you or an attacker, well, they made their choice. The bad thing happens to them. But there's the Sanhedrin again. There's a story about,
you know, one rabbi says the ideal would be that no capital punishment. You know, one person in 7 years, that's probably too much capital punishment. And the reply is, how about one every 70, right? So like even capital punishment within the community that inherited the book that has all these punishments that say they should be punished by death, even that community says, the book says death penalty, but we're still not into death penalty. So
take it easy.
Yeah, easy on the death penalty. God.
Jason, there's also an element here that while the Jews were not fans of murder in any form, the Greeks and the Romans were quite okay with killing children under various circumstances. And so thou shalt not murder may seem uncontroversial to us. It was a big deal back then because, for example, in my book here, it refers to the Roman historian Tacitus sneering. It says, it is a crime among the Jews to kill any child, as if to the Romans that was some sort of radical and ridiculous notion. So hooray for our monotheistic religions and not killing children.
Yeah. I mean, there's really a lot of stuff in here that we look back at and we were like, oh, 3,000 years, how antiquated. But like, there really is a lot of stuff within the Torah law that's, this was a step forward. Even some of the stuff that sound like some of the later stuff that sounds gross to us today is still at the time a step forward. Oh, also later verses like in Leviticus says a few different ways. Negligence is as bad as murder, right? Like if you can save someone and you don't, then that's as bad as if you, you know, actively did it yourself. And you can take any law to any extreme for any reason. You could use this commandment, you know, to be an extreme pacifist who literally would not hurt a fly, right? Or you could use this commandment to argue that you should be a vigilante who assassinates murderers, right? You could say, I'm the Punisher. I don't know if he was Jewish. As always, Jesus finds an extreme by counting anger as literally as bad as murder. And Jesus says, if someone hits you, give him another shot, right? And I don't think he does this to condemn and shame, but, you know, to eliminate as many moral gray areas as possible and to show all actions begin as thoughts, which, again, that springs not from some idea that Jesus was the first person to have, but I think from the 10th commandment and, you know, the later prophets and rabbis. All of Jesus' stuff, it's all very good and beautiful, but he wasn't the first person to say most of it. Number seven.
You shall not commit adultery.
I'll go ahead and agree to that one.
No, thank you. Me too.
This feels like a pretty easy.
Wife guy commandment.
Yes. I think we're beginning to see what went wrong for...
It's better when you realize the Ten Commandments was Moses tweeting through it.
I only have one note on this one. It's like not explained or defined or anything. It just says adultery. And like later laws and traditions make clear it's about a marriage going wrong. But youth pastors will forever insist it's about premarital makeouts and like premarital this and that. The Bible doesn't say a lot about premarital anything.
No. Like, but even as someone who was a pretty strict Christian kid, and that was, and I inflicted that upon myself because my parents didn't care. Adultery never meant any of that.
I will stick up for the Jews here, and while we can make Saturdays unfun, as a former Jewish summer camp counselor, we have no problems with adultery, and I'm using air quotes here, when it's two unmarried people exploring the wonders of adolescence together.
It's literally the first story in the Bible, is two unmarried people exploring adolescence together.
It's true.
Commandment 8.
Oh, wow, we're already on another one.
We're almost done.
You shall not steal.
This seems pretty easy too, right? We got another one in the books?
Yeah.
Yes. So it says steal, and that's it. But as you go through the rest of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and these other laws build on and expand on the basic 10, we start to see that it doesn't just mean the physical theft of physical objects. Here's some more socialist talk. Leviticus says, to buy a poor person's land and give them no path back to home ownership is wrong. Leviticus says some of your profits belong to poor people. Leviticus says wage theft is theft and nobody actually owns anything because it's all rented from God. So like there's this idea that's very popular to say on the internet that like, oh Jesus, I think he was a socialist. Well, yeah, have you met his dad? The Deuteronomy also makes clear failing to return a lost object could be considered stealing. Again, just like negligence with murder, the commandments aren't just don'ts, they're stuff you have to do. And speaking of the bad laws, I've read multiple Hebrew professors who have said that the verb choice, steal, indicates this could forbid selling someone into slavery, as in stealing their liberty, as in the troubling laws about how you should treat your slaves. I mean, those might be moot because it says right here, don't steal. So yeah, I mean, I think this don't steal, we agree with that on the face of it. But once you really look at the rest of the laws, it's even better.
It's interesting when you think about that one in terms of slaves, though, because the previous commandment literally talks about slaves.
Yeah. The idea of slaves in the Bible, like, yeah, that sucks. It sucks that it's in there. And it's been used to justify bad things. If we look back at the history, then there are parts that we can identify as being more about six-year terms of indentured servitude to pay off a debt that a person had no other way to pay off. This is different from the lifetime chattel bondage that existed in Egypt and in our supposedly civilized country within the memory of what our great-great-grandparents. In the Bible, when it refers to slaves, it's often, not always, often referring to a system of servitude that has an end and that is regulated. You know, in later in Exodus, it actually, I think the next chapter, it's, you can't kill your slaves. You can't, if you beat your slaves too badly, they go free. Like, it's not the most enlightened thing in the world, but literally compared to the last 200 years ago in this country, it's a step forward. And gosh, that's embarrassing. Any other thoughts on number 8? All right.
You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor.
So the rabbis, they talk about this when they take it to mean everything from like literally factual gossip, you know, just spreading news that is true. Everything from that to perjury in a death penalty case could fall under the ninth commandment. Deuteronomy adds to this, requiring multiple witnesses in court for a conviction. Jewish tradition, you know, goes heavy on warning witnesses not to perjure themselves. Multiple rabbis over the years have said gossip is basically murder. I mean, honestly, you can find anybody from the last 3,000 years arguing this or that commandment is as bad as murder.
I mean, it still is. You're not in as many circles as I am, probably, that have so much gossip, but it can literally ruin people. And especially because our daughter is a gymnast, so I'm involved in a lot of these gymnastics groups and things, and people are horrible. That's all I've learned. They're awful.
There was a tweet I meant to show you about like what it's like sharing gossip with a straight man. And the meme is just like blank face. That's like there's no actual curiosity or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like me telling him anything.
I think Emily hit on a big thing, which is that gossip can pollute a family for generations. Whereas, you know, all the other things that you're talking about, I mean, aside from obviously stopping somebody from having a family or ending their lives, gossip can really, it's something that some, especially in a small community, can always call back to and say, well, you're the son of this guy who did this other thing. And that's the kind of thing that can really, you know, make you a lesser member of a community.
It's toxic. It really is. There's just even little things that you don't think have any bearing. It just plays such a big role in how, if you're speaking to someone new in this environment or whatever, and you're telling them something about someone else, their thoughts immediately are poisoned over that person, whether it's true or not. And whether that person initially believes it or not, they've still heard it. That's their first impression. So I hate it. It's awful.
I think this was one that really, really lodged in my brain as a kid, because like this is one where the New Testament adds on it as well and like sort of lays out what slander means. And like I remember my dirtbag scumbag youth group friends, this was a thing that we took seriously. We had this worked out technical code of what was slander and what wasn't, and like we would all do this thing where like, hey man, we were all joking about you the other night. But like that's good, you know, that's better than like,
yeah,
people.
It's weird because growing up I was not a popular kid, and I wasn't an outcast. I was just me. I was kind of free-spirited, but that was how my family lived. And so I don't remember ever feeling like gossip was a big part of my day-to-day. But now as a mom, it's so much harder. Yeah. And sometimes it can be fun. Don't get me wrong, but it's also toxic.
That's why you need a rule against it, because it's fun.
Probably so.
If it was boring, you wouldn't need a rule.
Well, like everybody wants to hear the drama, but it's just, it's perpetuating that drama that can be really harmful.
Yeah, to kind of go along what was said earlier, as a teacher, I've had to, you know, do the restorative justice circles and bring people in just for either a rumor that went around that was just damaging to the entire class or to an entire like small community of 150 students. Like it can very easily see how this commandment was higher on the list of the 10 as opposed to, like, you know, the 613 plus.
Yeah, and the 613 do build on this one as well. But yeah, this is definitely a any of the 10 that you see, you can basically argue that there's 10 to 100 more that spring off of it, which further emphasize how important this one is. Number 10, a very important one.
You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or male or female slave or ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor.
So this one, why I think this one is so important is it's not about actions. It's not about physical actions. It's about thoughts, what's in your mind. It's about what's inspiring you to do specific things. First of all, remember neighbor means everybody. So there is no loophole there. This one does, again, to go back to Jesus, just because it's familiar to a lot of people, this does a lot of what Jesus does with the individual commandments. He shows it's not about just actions, but about your motives. It's about what's in your heart. And I've seen Deuteronomy 26, Jeremiah 31, and Ezekiel 36 mentioned as Hebrew Bible portions that also show how it's about your heart. The coveting commandment calls out people who will try to BS their way, you know, someone who would say, there's a years-long scheme, I was able to take my neighbor's house, a real estate scam. It wasn't technically stealing, it was all legal. But this...
paying $750 a year in taxes.
The 10th commandment is, it's about, did you follow the letter of the law or the spirit of the law, right? And I never thought about the 10th commandment that way, but I really like it because it covers a lot of bases, you know?
I think this is probably the hardest one for most people to follow, but it almost feels like more of something that you should be striving toward, because I think it's impossible to not have a thought of jealousy or...
It's especially interesting growing up Catholic, because what most interpretations are of the second commandment, the Catholics throw into the first, and they really hammer you with the Catholic guilt here.
Oh, yeah.
They split the 10th commandment specific coveting of thy neighbor's wife off into its own 9th commandment. So you have 2 commandments focused specifically on thou shalt not covet, and a second one, you're doubling down on the wife guy stuff, saying thou shalt not commit adultery, and then thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. So for Catholics in particular too, this is definitely like you feel that impact even just that much more about, hey, don't do this right. That way.
Yeah. There's, I forget exactly which version, there are 3 covet verses, yeah.
Yeah, this is the Catholic backdoor into purity culture too, growing up, like by separating that one out into its own commandment, the whole like, oh yeah, you shouldn't covet your neighbor's wife or anyone's wife or wives or women in general.
Yeah, really keeps it going, yeah. Yeah, as a kid, this one was like, I mean, this seems easy. I don't covet my neighbor's donkey. Done, right? But it's not about
that's,
that.
That's where I draw the line. I could follow this one up until that.
We're out on that one. Yeah, so that's it. That's 10 commandments. They end up inscribed on 2 stone tablets. These get broken, we'll discuss. 2 more stone tablets. They get sealed inside the Ark of the Covenant. Yes, the thing from Indiana Jones. The typical idea is there are 5 commandments on each. This is the usual standard interpretation. Something roughly like the God rules and the people rules. But one cool theory that I found is that if this is all modeled after a Hittite-style treaty, where the powerful party and the less powerful party, they each get a copy of the entire contract, that would mean if this worked in that fashion, God would take a copy and Moses would take a copy. But what happens in this story is the Israelites keep both copies sealed in the Ark of the Covenant, which means God is saying, I'm here with you the entire time. Like the Ark of the Covenant then is, you know, it's a symbol, it's the seat of God's power. But it's also literally saying, like, my part of the deal is right there with your part of the deal. And we don't know if that's what it is, because it doesn't really say, but it's a cool idea. The other interesting thing that I've seen the Hittites reference most frequently, so the law as a whole, the 613 or whatever commandments in the Torah, clearly influenced by really ancient Mesopotamian law codes. Everyone knows the Code of Hammurabi has influences, and yeah, but there's even older stuff as well, and we'll get to that. But the 10 commandments themselves, I've seen a lot of Exodus scholars seem to view them as most specifically inspired by the way Hittite treaties are structured. And I've seen it, the Lexham Bible Dictionary broke it down. You know, you have a preamble, I am the Lord your God, a historical prologue telling you how we came to this point, brought you out of Egypt, stipulations, the commandments, depositions, they're written down and stored. Michael, we're really speaking your language now, right? And you have witnesses. And this is, so as always, when the Bible uses a story from elsewhere in the Middle East,
the big key is not the similarities. Like, it's easy to say, oh, Noah's like Gilgamesh. It's the differences. In the creation story, the big difference from the older Mesopotamian stories was that God created the world not with violence, but with words. And he created the world not to enslave people, but to give it to people. In the flood story, the difference is that God is doing it to purge evil, not because he wants peace and quiet, which is how it worked how it worked in Gilgamesh. In the Ten Commandments, one huge difference between the Bible and other God treaty stories is that the witnesses in the Bible's treaty are not other gods, but other people. God is here among us, playing on our terms, giving us both copies of the contract, and everyone who is witnessing it is us. God doesn't really need backup. He's God. The Ten Commandments get mentioned and referenced several other times in the Bible, rarely verbatim. That means, including by Moses himself, that means people were discussing and interpreting these things right away and for centuries. When Jesus summarizes his view of the commandments, he's the latest in a long line of rabbis to do so. The prophets within the Bible did this. Deuteronomy repeats the Ten Commandments, but with different wording, changing the explanation for the Sabbath from remembering the seventh day of creation to remembering the Exodus. The fun story here that you can read in if you like is if Moses wrote this, then he's writing down the commandments a second time in Deuteronomy. He can't go crack open the Ark of the Covenant to check. He's doing it from memory. So what's fresh in his mind? The Exodus. We've been doing this whole time. So like, yeah, sure. We have a good idea that different authors wrote this, you know, hundreds of miles, possibly hundreds of years, possibly apart. But if you follow the storyline, Moses just forgot what the original thing was, and he can't look it up to check because it's sealed in the Ark. Last thing here. The Ten Commandments are special for a few reasons. They're blunt. They're simple compared to the nitty-gritty stuff in the rest of the law, which sort of spring out from these main 10 things. Even if you can't learn and remember all 613, you can remember most of the 10, or you can remember the 7 Noahide laws, or you can just elect to try and keep like 3 of them. And okay, that's a good start. They're about interpersonal ethics, not just religious ritual or devotion. So many ancient gods only care about being elevated and served. In Moses' words, this God cares about people being good to each other. There have since been a million ideas on all of this. One Catholic idea is that when Jesus fulfills the law, he replaces almost all of them except the 10. And then that's it. The 10, no matter what spring from them, will always be with us. So that's the deal. Do we click to the next page of the terms and conditions? Sure, just keep clicking.
I thought it was interesting that the 10 commandments are 120 words. Which is a remarkably short amount for something so significant. And I compared that to, I looked up the Gettysburg Address, which is noted for its remarkable brevity, and that was 272 words. So kudos to God for doing in less than half the words that it took Abe Lincoln to do the most famous speech in American history. Kudos for brevity.
Definitely one thing the Bible is known for.
Yeah.
Yeah, just wait for Leviticus. Numbers,
hey, thank you to everybody who joined us for this. This was very fun. We will try to do stuff like this again in the future. Special thanks to Michael and Hassan for contributing to our Interfaith Council and to all of our Patreon early service and associate pastor folks and our love offering folks as well. Even a dollar is a love offering, of course. Everybody on here had fun stuff to say. We have many other people who we would like to get on here in the future. Maybe you'll hear some lady voices at some point. We also followed this episode with almost an hour of like fellowship Q&A type stuff that we will set aside as an episode for Patreon early service exclusive. On this main feed next time, we will either have the golden calf and finally finishing Exodus, or maybe it's time for a Christmas episode. We'll see which happens first. Thank you as always for listening. If you'd like to support, we're on Twitter and Instagram, VBS Podcast on both, jasonkirk.substack.com for the newsletter, where we also are maintaining a sort of a works cited page. Got some stuff to add to it. Patreon.com/VBS Podcast, of course. And that's it. Thank you. Thank you for listening.